if aid is slow coming to flow in, if people are still unable to move into accommodation, if the services are not being provided, if Israel is still in any way, shape or form involved in Gaza for an extended period, all of these things provide an opportunity for Hamas to reconstruct the narrative, and in a time-honoured way, don't be so surprised if in years to come, the 7th of October is viewed as a striking victory for Hamas.
Dr. Roger Shanahan is one of Australia's foremost experts on Middle Eastern politics and society. For 25 years, Roger was an officer in the Australian Army, where he saw operational service in South Lebanon and Syria, Afghanistan and Beirut. He was the former director of the Australian Army's Land Warfare Studies Centre and a non-resident fellow at the Lowe Institute, Australia's premier institute for the study of international affairs. Roger is a frequent commentator on Middle Eastern politics and is the author of numerous books on the region, including Islamic State in Australia. Roger joined me to talk about Israel's war in Gaza, how it's been conducted, what it will mean for the peace process, and how, we hope, it might soon end. Roger Shanahan, welcome to Meridian 100.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Paul.
Roger, the war in Gaza has been going now for 5 months. The death toll has been reported as having exceeded 30,000 civilians, or 30,000 Gazans, I should say. Critics have accused Israel of using disproportionate force in its war against Hamas. Is that true?
Proportionality is a very subjective term, and I suppose this is why it's very difficult to make accurate assessments of it, because there's different elements of proportionality. It could be, are we talking about the overall strategic conduct of the campaign? Is it proportionate? Is Israel's strategic methodology for waging this campaign proportionate to the threat? Down to the tactical level, are individual soldiers using proportionate force to neutralize threats on the ground? So unless you know each individual incident or the methodology by which the IDF is using its targeting mechanisms to prosecute the war, it's really, really difficult to make a value judgment on proportionality. That having been said, you would have to think that the amount of ordnance that has been dispatched in such a relatively limited geographical area over a relatively limited time span compared to some other recent conflicts certainly raises questions about whether the proportionality test has been met. But unless we know a lot more information about the targets prosecuted, what kind of weapons have been used against them, were they appropriate, it's very difficult to make a judgment about whether Israel's conduct of the campaign has been proportionate.
We can answer elements of that question, can't we? I mean, we know that they're using a lot of high explosive ordnance, a lot of bunker busting bombs to get into this sort of subterranean network in which Hamas hides. And by its nature, that's going to kill a lot of civilians and destroy a lot of civilian infrastructure. Is it appropriate to be using that kind of ordnance on the scale that Israel is now using it or has been using it?
Well, listen, you don't normally talk about proportionality in isolation. So the test is normally military necessity and proportionality. Is it militarily necessary to prosecute that target? And again, we're into the subjective judgment area. One of the difficulties of prosecuting this war from the Israeli side is that Hamas has conducted its military operations, built its tunnel network in and amongst the civilian population. So there's no real way of prosecuting the targets without dropping high explosive ordnance in civilian populated areas. And because of the nature of the tunnels themselves, you're going to have to use very large high explosive ordnance, as you mentioned previously, 2,000 pound bombs, 1,000 pound bombs, to prosecute targets that are well underground. And part of the issue is you might know where they are underground, but you do not necessarily know what's contained in them. So there could be secondary explosions, for instance, that you don't know about because you don't know what is in the tunnel. So when you're prosecuting a target, for instance, in a built-up area, first of all, is the target that you are after a high-value target that has a high degree of military necessity? And then if you decide that it is, how are you going to prosecute that target, and what kind of civilian casualties will you accept? Will you accept 10 people dying because that's worth the value of the person that you're killing? But given that it's an imperfect science, the angle of attack, there might be explosives stored in the tunnel network, there's big secondary explosions, you kill 60 or 80 people. Is that a war crime, or is that just the nature of war? That's on one side. On the other side of the issue is, if there are a couple of Hamas fighters shooting at you from a building and you could easily maneuver your way around that building and isolate them and take care of them later, does that necessitate the fact that you have to call in an aircraft to destroy that target and potentially other civilians who are still in that building? So well, these are the kind of issues you've got to talk about.
Well, that leads me to my next question, which is, are there alternatives to the way Israel could be fighting this war? I mean, it's been conducted largely from the air. Most of the casualties, civilian and Hamas casualties, have been inflicted, as I understand it, via airstrikes. Are there other ways that Israel could prosecute this war against Hamas, namely a greater use of ground troops? And would alternatives like that reduce the civilian death toll?
Yeah, listen, there are always different ways to prosecute a ground campaign. It depends on whether you're willing to accept the cost of prosecuting it in a different way. So certainly you can reduce the air-delivered ordnance, you can reduce the amount of artillery that you use and increase the degree by which you conduct ground manoeuvre against targets without the supporting fires. And that will, in all likelihood, reduce civilian casualties, but it will also significantly increase Israeli military casualties. And therefore, it becomes a political decision. What is your political risk acceptance regarding your own casualties? If you want to minimize the casualties as far as possible, then you will increase the use of fire support to do that. And by doing that, you will obviously increase the number of civilians killed.
So it's possible Israel could reduce civilian casualties potentially by increasing its use of ground forces, but that would result in more IDF casualties.
There are multiple ways that you can cut the cake, but for simplicity's purposes, it's reasonable to explain to people that, yes, you can reduce civilian casualties, but it will come with a concomitant increase in Israeli military casualties.
What about this question of war crimes? Israel has been accused of committing war crimes. It's been accused of genocide. We'll leave the question of genocide to one side for the moment. But on this issue of war crimes, well, I was going to ask you whether or not Israel has, in your view, committed war crimes, but I think you'll say we don't know yet because we don't have enough evidence. What I'll ask you instead then is, are there credible public indicators that Israel may have committed war crimes?
Well, it's a really difficult and very vexed issue, isn't it, this issue of war crimes, which kind of gets thrown around, the term gets thrown around pretty readily. I think to start with, you've got to look at the way that Hamas has deployed itself. So Hamas, you're not supposed to put military targets in built-up areas because the obvious issue, your enemy is going to have to target those, and that will increase the risk of casualties, of civilian casualties. So to start with, the simple fact that Hamas's security and military posture within Gaza, you could describe that as a war crime even before you start. Then you get onto the issue of how is Israel prosecuting those targets. And we come back to that, what we said before. Has it met the tests of proportionality and military necessity? And that's a really subjective measure, both in the macro and the micro level. So you just end up getting into really big arguments about relatively small issues in the greater scheme of things, but with incomplete information. Unless you know the information that the decision maker at that point in time made and was available to him or her, then you can't say whether it's a war crime or not. Other issues, perhaps there is greater scope given what we know at the moment, collective punishment,
but
cutting off services.
Can I stop you there? I mean, does the whatever you think about Israel's prosecution of the war in Gaza, can you make the argument that what they're doing is collective punishment? Because I thought in law, and I stand to be corrected obviously by you on this, but I thought collective punishment was something that happens, say in a POW camp where one person tries to escape and 10 people get shot as a consequence. Have I got that wrong, or could it be applied to what's happening in Gaza?
No, you could certainly apply it to what's happening in Gaza in terms of forcible removal of people from their homes. Could be termed a collective punishment, but then Israelis would argue that they're trying to reduce civilian casualties by creating not free fire zones, but areas where it's much easier to prosecute it. If you're cutting off water and food to people, that's a much stronger argument about collective punishment. If you're not allowing in sufficient humanitarian aid or not allowing it in a manner in which it can reach the people, that's also a much stronger argument about collective punishment.
And just on that point, I mean, that would seem to be a more credible claim against Israel at this stage. I mean, if you look at the humanitarian situation in Gaza and those awful scenes we saw last week, well, those Israeli aid convoys were overrun, and now we're seeing airdrops of supplies into Gaza. And some have suggested that there might even be famine in Gaza. Is that a more credible claim against Israel?
Yeah, listen, I think what you have to look when you look at the Israeli actions, you have to look at everything to do with it, not just the present time and not necessarily just the fighting. So when you're doing your campaign plan, one of the things that we might talk about later is, you know, the day after, there doesn't seem to be much, if any, clarity about what happens the day after. But there's also with Israel saying they were requiring the population to move from the north to the south in the earlier stages of the fighting because they wanted to clear it of civilians as much as possible. That's all well and good. But if you're telling people to move to the south, you have to make provisions for them to be sheltered in the south, to be able to access water in the south, to be able to access food in the south. Simply saying, listen, we're moving you south, and then you look after yourselves, that without providing them the means of subsistence, if you do that, that's a much stronger argument, I would say, for collective punishment.
And what about this issue or this accusation of genocide? It's thrown about pretty liberally these days. What's your take on that?
Well, listen, I'm not a lawyer, and this issue is being debated hotly in international criminal environments. But I think as the as an average person in the street, to my way of thinking, it'd be hard to say, while I think you can make an argument for collective punishment, I think it's a much more difficult argument to say that there is genocide, because there is a degree of discrimination being conducted by the Israelis. They're not looking to eliminate Palestinian national identity necessarily, their future as a people. So those kind of markers for the average person, I don't think would be met when people are talking about is Israel guilty of genocide. It's a very, very emotional issue. It's a very emotional term, and it's thrown around a bit like war crimes by a lot of people without knowing exactly what it means.
All right. Look, we focused a lot on Israel. What about Hamas? Hamas, we know, killed 1,200 people thereabouts on October 7. It committed sexual violence on a mass scale against Israeli women. It abducted Israeli civilians and took them back into Gaza. It, as you say, has based its entire military infrastructure and operations beneath civilian areas. It is a flagrant human rights abuser and war criminal, is it not, as an organisation?
Oh, listen, I don't think there's much argument that what Hamas did on 7th of October would have constituted a war crime. And I think we also have to understand...
Can I stop you there, though? But has that been... Well, no, I wouldn't say forgotten in the public discussion, but has it been downplayed or de-emphasised in favour of Israel's supposed crimes? You know, are there two standards being applied here?
Yeah, I think it's a reasonable argument to say that. It's very convenient for people to gloss over it, and I don't think it should be glossed over in any way, shape or form. And not only the people who executed it, it's the people who planned it, knowing exactly what was going to happen as a result of it. And there are arguments that perhaps they didn't know they would have that degree of success against, or success if you want to call it that way, against Israel. And so they didn't think that they would be able to capture that many hostages or kill that many people. But regardless, that was at the upper end of their aspirations, I'm sure. And I think it's just the... after the 7th of October, it's the nature of the response that has overshadowed to some degree what happened on the 7th of October. But I don't think we should ever forget that. What has also been forgotten, I think, to a large degree, is people are talking about, people on the pro-Palestinian side of the more radical view, is that it was a legitimate act of resistance, killed 1,200 Israelis. That doesn't justify 30,000 Palestinians being killed. But we also have to remember, out of that 1,200, there are a couple of hundred non-Israelis, international citizens, who were not only killed, but they're also taken as hostages. Europeans, Thais, people from a number of countries. So Hamas did not discriminate. And one of the reasons why the international community was so unified to start with was because this was an attack not only against Israel, but a large number of other countries who weren't involved in the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Roger, you're an expert on the Middle East, and you're an expert on these on organisations like Hamas. Very briefly, tell our listeners a little bit about Hamas. Tell us about the origins of the group and tell us about its objectives.
Listen, it's very difficult in a short space of time, but essentially Hamas has grown out of the Muslim Brotherhood, which is not an unusual start point for a number of organisations, Islamist political organisations. But Hamas has, for a long time, as part of its charter, rejected the reality of Israel as a state, either pre or post 1967 borders. When you look at the Palestinian territories, they're divided into West Bank, which is controlled by Fatah, and also Gaza, which is controlled by Hamas, a much more Islamist political and security organization. It has controlled Gaza since the mid-2000s. So when we look at who could control Gaza after, this is one of the issues, that it really has no political alternative in Gaza. And Fatah, who's in control of the West Bank, very, very questionable indeed as to whether, even if they wanted to, they'd be capable of running Gaza.
Is Hamas a Palestinian nationalist organization, or is it an Islamist group, or is it some combination of the two?
A combination of the two. You know, it's a listed terrorist organization by a significant number of countries, including Australia. But like a range of other groups, as you said previously, that emerge out of groups like Muslim Brotherhood, they see a central role for Islam within whatever governance model is put in place when they're eventually successful. So,
And can they? The question, I suppose, or perhaps it's a moot question now, but pre-October 7, the question might have been, could you ever see them striking any accommodation with Israel for a political solution?
Potentially. Yeah, when we're talking about what is the two-state solution, you know, Hamas would have had to have been part of that conversation. Now, are they able to, while they publicly call as part of their charter for the destruction of Israel, as we all know, these kind of things can be flexible, and there have been indications that Hamas could have been on board for an Israel in its pre-1967 boundaries. But the reality is, could that ever be achieved? So it's a bit of a moot point. Theoretically, yes. Practically, it's very difficult to say these days whether Hamas could have acceded to be a partner in a two-state solution.
Well, the Israeli objection, not unreasonably, is that the Hamas charter calls for the destruction of Israel. On that point, how sincere are they? I mean, you would say after October 7 that the indications are they are very, very sincere, but you might have a different view. Are they committed to the destruction of Israel, or is that something that you say in order to play to the Arab street, as the term has it?
Probably a bit of both, but more the latter. I mean, you have to differentiate yourself practically, but ideologically, you have to put yourself out there as, you know, the torchbearer of Palestinian nationalism in the way that you aspire to a Palestine, how you conceive it in the pre-1948 structure. Now, practically speaking, that's not achievable, and every pragmatist within Hamas would understand that, but that doesn't mean that that's not what you say publicly. We then come to the issue of, so what would satisfy Hamas? And that's very, very difficult to say prior to 7th of October, way more difficult to say post 7th of October, even if Hamas is going to be part of that conversation.
Well, I'd say it's surely academic now, because whatever Hamas's position or inclination might be Israel's stated aim is the destruction of Hamas. So on that question, Roger, is that a realistic objective?
Listen, in reality, we talk a fair bit about terminology in this podcast, but destruction to any military mind would tell you it's virtually impossible to destroy an organization. That's a political term, and that's what was said by Prime Minister Netanyahu and a number of other members of his government. For the IDF operational planners, it would be to degrade them militarily to the point at which they're no longer militarily effective, and at the upper level to make sure that politically they have no future say in what political solution comes out of this in the future.
But surely that's the point, isn't it? I mean, I think we can acknowledge that in the purest sense it's not possible to eliminate the organisation or wipe it from the face of the earth. But you can do what you've just described, which is denude it to the point where it's militarily ineffective and it's politically irrelevant. Or can you? Can you not do that?
Yeah, and this is the question. In order to answer that, you have to know what the day after and 5 years after the day after is going to look like. If you're the kind of people who would plan and execute a 7th of October attack, and you're the people who are willing to live underground for months in the face of an Israeli ground offensive against you, you are fairly well committed to your cause. So this idea, and we're going to have to see over the ensuing months and years whether the retribution brought upon the Gazans by Israel has meant that Gazans themselves have no truck with Hamas, or is it not the complete opposite, but the degree to which Israel has destroyed Gazan infrastructure and the way in which Hamas has, as far as they've been able to, inflict some casualties on the Israeli military. What do the Gazans think in 2 years, 3 years, 4 years from now? Will they have completely isolated Hamas because they blame them for all of the ills that has happened to them? Or are their memories so short that they'll forget 7th of October and they'll remember the months after 7th of October? And a lot of that, as you said at the start, will depend on how their lives look in a few years from now. And that, in turn, will depend on what are the governance structures for Gaza after the fighting is over. And that's the bit we don't know.
Could all of this change, or will all of this change, if and when Israel succeeds in killing or capturing some of the Hamas executive team, the leadership? Because one of the things that's been striking in the campaign is that for all of the destruction and death that it has occasioned, whatever you think about that from a moral point of view, they have not, it would seem, been effective in targeting or dismantling Hamas's leadership. And we record this, I should say, in the first week of March, so perhaps by the time we drop this podcast that will have changed. But presumably at some point they will start to target effectively Hamas's leadership. Will that change Hamas's prospects? Will that change the course of the war?
I think it'll change the course of the war, but as you pointed out, we don't know exactly who has been killed or who remains alive. But certainly in the public's mind, you would think that is one of the things that Netanyahu would have to be able to point to before he accedes to
pulls back.
A longer term. Yeah, because you need, to use the term, you need it, a head on a stick, or quite a few heads on sticks, and they haven't had those at the moment. So you can't say that you have, if your aim is to destroy Hamas, but you haven't destroyed its political leadership, then you haven't achieved the mission aim, regardless of what you've done to its security apparatus. So very much so, I think that is something that has to be completed. That having been said, I'll go back to what I said before. Yes, certainly you kill this leadership, but what does that mean down the track? There is always somebody willing to step up to take over, because you're talking about Gazans in Gaza. It's not like groups like Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, who had so much to their support and their base of fighters who weren't indigenous to the country. Hamas is indigenous to the country. So whether they're Hamas fighters today but not tomorrow, they're still going to be there.
Well, look, whether or not Israel destroys this organisation, whether or not Israel removes its leadership, one thing is clear is that Israel will not deal with Hamas again, which raises the question, what does the future of Gaza look like? At some point, hopefully very soon, this war will end and Gaza will, in the short term, perhaps the long term, fall under Israeli administration. But what does governance in Gaza look like in the short to medium or even the long term?
And this is the $64,000 question. And when you talk about mission success or mission failure, this is what will define that in the future. And it just doesn't seem as though the Israeli government paid much attention to that. And you could say that there was a need to enact retribution as quickly as possible, but those were tactical considerations. A strategic consideration is exactly what you said, and nobody appears to be putting their hands up to do that. Are the Palestinians from the West Bank, are they, based on historical evidence, have relatively little support in Gaza? If, after what has been happening in Gaza over the past few months, would Gazans be happy to have West Bank Palestinians decide their political future? If not them, then who is going to do it? Is it feasible for an international organisation to do it?
I was going to say, I mean, could it be governed, or as some have suggested, under some kind of international or, you know, Arab-led mandate? I mean, one thing we know is that Hamas is out. Israel will not countenance any role for Hamas, obviously. Where does that leave the issue?
Well, it's a little bit like you have to be very careful about saying Hamas has no role in this, because, you know, many of the technocrats would be sympathetic to members of Hamas, and it's a bit like the Baathists post-US invasion of Iraq. You can't purge Gaza of Hamas influence, whether you call it Hamas or something else, that's entirely different. Then the other issue is, who is going to, any governance organisation, be it an international organisation, can't rely on Israeli security, or else it will lose the support of the local population if it's seen to be essentially doing the political aspects of Israeli military control. But if Israel is not going to provide security, then who's going to do it? What external country is going to want to do, provide security in Gaza, not only for other Gazans, but to satisfy the Israelis that nobody's going to start lobbing rockets back at Israel? It is the kind of issue where there are only problems, and there are so many downsides to anybody else becoming involved in it, that I don't really have an answer for you at the moment, but, and neither does the international community.
It seems to me that, and I defer to you on this, but it seems to me that the more likely outcome, certainly in the short term and probably the medium term, is extended Israeli occupation of Gaza for the reasons you've just described, that it's a problem no one else is going to want.
Yeah, and I think this is the issue, and they've been sending mixed messages about that. The last thing that Israel would want, and I think the Israeli population more broadly would want, is an occupation of Gaza. There's the cost associated with it. There's the international opprobrium that would come onto the Israeli government for not only smashing Gaza, but then occupying it. And above all, who is going to pay for the reconstruction of Gaza if Israel is occupying it? There's no external donor, certainly no local Arab donor, who's going to pay to reconstruct a place that Israel is occupying. So where does that leave Israel? It might have to be some kind of loose arrangement where security is guaranteed, in inverted commas, by Israel, but gives them an air gap from the people who are trying to reconstruct Gaza. But yeah, who knows what that would look like.
Let's turn very briefly to the politics of the situation. How has the October 7 attack and the war in Gaza changed the standing of the two belligerents, Prime Minister Netanyahu and Hamas? On the former, there's a fairly widely held view that his political career is finished once this war is concluded. And also, on that same question, Hamas. What is Hamas's standing among Gazans and Palestinians likely to be when this war is finished?
Both good and very difficult questions to answer. Prime Minister Netanyahu is nothing if not a survivor, and certainly you would think that in the normal course of events, the 7th of October attack happened on the Prime Minister's watch, and whichever way you cut it, ultimately the primary responsibility of the national political leader is to guarantee the security of its citizens. If he can't have done that, then surely he has failed in his primary mission. That's how the normal way of thinking goes. Is he able to survive this? You would think that he would have to push it out as far as possible, because an inquiry or the next general election are probably only two things that would he would fear at the moment. And there are first rumblings you can see in Israeli political leadership that perhaps, or Netanyahu's rivals, that perhaps the only way to sort this out is an early general election. So I think the Israeli domestic political scene has got a long way to go at the moment. But it's also difficult to understand how this would play out given the anger felt in Israel about the 7th of October attacks and the need to deal with Hamas. Would people be able to forget or forgive the obvious lack of security under Netanyahu's watch on the 7th of October and reward him for dealing so ferociously with Hamas if there was an election? Really difficult to tell. On the Hamas side, I think we come back to that issue. What are we going to do in 2, 3, 4 years time? If what replaces Hamas-led Gaza is much better than what it was before, you give yourself the best chance of Hamas's rationale as the eternal resistance model, the best chance of being negated. However, if aid is slow coming to flow in, if people are still unable to move into accommodation, if the services are not being provided, if Israel is still in any way, shape or form involved in Gaza for an extended period, all of these things provide an opportunity for Hamas to reconstruct the narrative, and in a time-honoured way, don't be so surprised if in years to come, the 7th of October is viewed as a striking victory for Hamas or other Islamist groups because they achieved something in Israel that other groups had not been able to, regardless of the death and destruction that they have wrought upon Gaza as a result of those actions. Sometimes the way in which people form narratives can be really difficult to understand. So while surely Hamas, as of the 4th of March, is combat ineffective and is hunkering down for survival, one of the other and probably the most important driver for getting the post-conflict phase right from an Israeli perspective is that is the best way of delegitimizing Hamas, because Hamas has really only got a resistance narrative attached to it. If there is still a reason to resist, then they're still relevant.
What about the two-state solution? Public opinion polling suggests that support for the two-state solution has collapsed in both Israel and among Palestinians. Is it dead for the foreseeable future or dead for good?
Oh, listen, it's the theory and practice. In theory, no, it's not. Not dead. It's still the accepted normative outcome, and so many other things rest on...
Well, the only long-term solution to the issue, I would think.
Yes, correct. But it's how you get there. You know, there have been hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers over the past 20 years when we were last close to getting potentially a peace deal. Hundreds of thousands of Israeli settlers have moved into occupied areas. So practically speaking, how do you deal with that political constituency? Is any Israeli government in the future or now ever willing to deal with that issue or capable of dealing with that issue in the future? And what Palestinian authority or authorities are going to undertake negotiations over a two-state solution if Israel's not going to deal with those hundreds of thousands of settlers? And you know, this land for peace concept is becomes even more complicated the more and more people you put on those lands, so you have less and less land to swap for peace. That's why I say, when we keep on coming back to that issue, politically speaking, it is the only solution that could in any way, shape or form guarantee a peaceful future between Palestinians and Israelis. But practically speaking, every week and every month that we go down the track, it's becoming increasingly hard to see practically how it could ever be achieved.
Well, I'm going to put you on the spot as we finish up and ask you, do you think it is achievable? What is your view? Where do you think this will be in 10, 15 years, 20 years?
there's the glass half full, glass half empty person. I've always been the glass half full person. And you would think if, when wiser heads prevail in a perhaps post-inquiry period, if there is a sidelining of Hamas and a post-Hamas political rule in Gaza and a reconstruction project in Gaza that makes the Gazans better off than they were previously, but without the rule of Hamas, and there is no Prime Minister Netanyahu in the seat anymore, it is possible that you could perhaps restart negotiations at some time in the future, and there might be a hope for a two-state solution. That's the glass half full in me. The glass half empty is that circumstances on the ground quite deliberately have made a practical two-state solution virtually impossible to achieve. And so in 10 or 15 years' time, we'll be in a position not that dissimilar to where we are today.
Roger Shanahan, thanks for joining us on Meridian 100.
Yeah, thanks very much, Paul.
That was Roger Shanahan. I'm Paul Maley. Please join me next time for another episode of Meridian 100.